Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. As you may or may not know, Slackware divides its installable packages into a series of subdirectories, folders. When you download the installer for Slackware, you're essentially downloading these folders, and one of those folders is XAP. That refers to applications that require X, X being the graphical server, meaning that there's some component to these applications that display graphics or, you know, a graphical user interface. That's where we are now. We were in just the X directory last episode. That was the X directory itself, like the graphical server. So these are applications that basically depend on X. These are the applications that, unlike applications in the A directory or the, what is it, AP directory, I think, or AAA directory, I guess, all of those, like, earlier folders that just referred to applications, those were valid applications, but they ran in a terminal. You typed them in through, you know, you ran them through commands. These applications are designed assuming you've got a desktop or a window manager. You've got some kind of GUI on your screen, and you're using applications that you would expect to utilize that GUI. So the first one up is not alphabetical exactly, because the way that this gets sorted by the Apache web server index listing are that capital letters come first. So this is alphabetical in order of capitalization. MPlayer, M as in movie or media, probably media player. This is a player that launches from a terminal, but of course gives you a window in which your media appears. So it's not like you're playing a movie in a terminal. It just happens to be a command that you use to launch a dedicated window that then plays the media file of your choice. And the most basic syntax for that is pretty intuitive, really. It's MPlayer and then the path to the file you want to play. Press return and your movie is playing. Now, the beauty of MPlayer that a lot of other players don't quite integrate as strongly as MPlayer does are the keyboard shortcuts. I mean, yeah, lots of things have keyboard shortcuts, and if you know them, they are useful, but I don't know, maybe it's because it's all it's got, but MPlayer has a really strong sort of grasp of how powerful a really good set of keyboard commands really are. Everything you do in MPlayer, once it's playing, everything you do is just, it's keyboard presses. So you can go left or right, arrow keys for going back or forward 1 second. You can do up and down to go forward a minute, and then page up and page down for forward or back 10 minutes. That's pretty good. You can also do brackets to decrease or increase the playback speed by 10% increments, curly braces to halve or double the current playback speed, backspace to reset the playback speed to just normal. There's F for full screen. There's P for pause or space for pause. Q or escape to stop. Lowercase V to make subtitles appear or not appear, which is great. I mean, think of how many times you've gone to a drop-down menu to turn off a subtitle that comes on by, automatically. You can even do really, really esoteric things like maybe your audio is a little bit out of sync. Well, plus or minus adjusts an audio delay by 0.1 seconds. Slash and asterisk will decrease or increase your volume, or just 9 and 0. That's probably the one you're going to use. I mean, that seems to make a lot more sense to me. M for muting sound. And then one I use all the time is O to show or not show the on-screen display. So, like, you know, the data about what you're playing, like how many seconds into the video you are and that sort of thing. And it just goes on and on. I mean, take a look at the man page for MPlayer right after the description. It's all about the keyboard commands, the keyboard shortcuts. So it's all listed there. I imagine if you were going to use InPlayer frequently, you might print that section out as kind of a cheat sheet, and eventually they'll work them their way into your memory, obviously, the more you use them. But it's really, really, like, you can do just so much. I mean, I've already mentioned, like, the audio delay. 1 and 2 adjusts contrast. 3, 4 adjusts brightness up and down. 5 and 6 adjusts the hue. 7 and 8 adjusts the saturation. I mean, they've just kind of thought of everything, and not all of it is intuitive. I mean, how do you remember that 5 and 6 is for the hue and 3 and 4 is for brightness? Why isn't it the other way around? There's no reason. It's just that's you needed keys for it, and that's what got assigned. But that's okay. Like I say, you can either print this out as a cheat sheet and just remember to look at that, you know, for the couple of times that you actually do need to adjust, I don't know, the saturation of an image or you know, a playing movie. It's an alternative, really, to having drop-down menus. Is it better? Maybe not. I mean, it certainly is different. And I find with something like VLC or Dragon, where you do have to go to the menus, that can be a little bit disruptive. It just feels different than pressing keys, because you don't really necessarily, I don't know, when you're watching a movie, you don't expect there to be a drop-down menu for some reason. Maybe it's just years and years of watching things on the big screen or on a TV. You just don't think of it as a drop-down menu situation. Whereas, yeah, some on-screen displays, maybe that's okay, but even so, like, just being able to touch a key and just having things change and do what you want them to do, It's really sublimely smooth. It just happens. Things adjust themselves. Well, they don't just adjust themselves, but they appear to be adjusting themselves. And it's a great feeling. So InPlayer, really powerful playback device. I mean, it just is. And the keyboard, it starts with the keyboard shortcuts. It doesn't stop there. There's also a really cool mode or mechanism, rather, for what's called an EDL. An EDL in the film biz is an edit decision list. It's a pretty common thing. Now, unfortunately, InPlayer kind of abuses the term and kind of flips it on its head, but it's still a useful mechanism. It's just, if you did work in film and you knew the term EDL, this is the inverse of that. It still works. It's still very cool, so I'll talk about it. EDL, you can make these yourself, or you can make them really, really cool that you can make them as a movie plays. This is really neat. So, InPlayer. If you want to watch a movie and decide which parts you'd rather never see again. Maybe it's a horror movie. You don't do well with gore. Why are you watching a horror movie then? But there's one scene maybe that you just, that's too much. I'll skip that one. Or probably more commonly, there are commercials and you don't want to see the commercials. You drop those. This isn't an automated thing. You have to manually decide what you want to drop, but you can do that as it plays to make it really simple. So you launch InPlayer with the option -EDL out and then a file name, like myedl.txt. Anytime as the movie plays, you can hit the I key on your keyboard to mark in, and then press it again to mark out. Now you have just defined a region that, if you play it again with the EDL in action, then that section of between those two I key presses, it just won't play. It'll skip it. So, for instance, if a commercial starts and you hit I, and then the commercial ends and you hit I, the next time you play it using that EDL as input this time, it'll just skip that section, those commercials. Really, really useful. The reason I say this is the inverse of what someone in film would expect is usually you're doing an EDL to mark the places that you do want to play. You want to keep the two sections, so you're trimming off the parts outside of the eye, rather than trimming out the parts between the eyes. So it doesn't quite, it, like, there is a definite, especially if you know the term. I mean, if you don't know the term, then it just seems natural to you. But if you know the term, this is the opposite. Or, I guess said another way, it is a very simple concept made a lot more complex. Like instead of two things, like two steps, you now have four. So in other words, if there was let's say you only wanted the commercials, the way I would do that in video editing is mark in and then mark out and you're done. Now you've kept the section between the in and the out. But with InPlayer, you'd have to mark in at the very beginning and then out right before the commercial, and then the commercial plays and then in and then wait till the very end of the movie and mark out. Like that would just, like, why would you do that? That just doesn't make any sense. Like, let's mark everything except the part we want to keep. It just doesn't make any sense. So anyway, if you don't know about EDLs before just now, then that doesn't matter to you. You won't care. I do kind of wish that the InPlayer team would respect the term EDL, because to some people's language that actually means a thing, and this is not what that is, so it's very confusing. I wish they would have called this something else, like maybe a DDL, a drop decision list, I don't know, something. Exclusion, well, yeah, XDL, exclusion, dropping the E, whatever it is, it shouldn't be EDL. But it's still a very cool mechanism. So, -edl out myedl.txt, that generates your EDL file. Then the next time you play that movie, or whatever it is, you do InPlayer -edl, InPlayer, you know, the movie file, -edl myedl.txt, and then hit return, and now you're playing the movie, but you won't see the parts that you marked. There's another nuance to EDL, and that is that you can either drop the video or you can just drop the audio. So in the EDL file, if you look at it, I mean, it's super easy to generate just by typing as well. You don't have to do it by pressing I. If you know the time that you want to drop, you can just enter that into your EDL. Well, by seconds. It's a bit weird. It doesn't use time code, as far as I know, unless there's some secret option, but it uses seconds, which no one, that's not how people, that's another sort of disconnect between the term and the implementation. But anyway, you can put in the second marker, you know, the seconds, how many seconds you want to, where you want to mark in, and then how many seconds you want to mark out. And then at the end of the line, the third value on each EDL line is either a 0 or a 1. A 0 means drop the video and implicitly the audio. So just skip the section entirely. There's no break. You don't notice any. It just cuts. Just from here to there. There, done. If you put a 1 there, though, it means just drop the audio. Just mute the audio, which is an interesting option. So I guess maybe you want to see the commercials, but you don't want to hear them. You could do, you know, like, let's say it starts at 21 seconds. So 21 space. And then let's say it goes on for, I don't know, until 81 seconds. So 81 is the second value. And then 1 for the third value means mute the audio. So from 21 to 81, you just wouldn't hear anything. I could imagine people doing this for, like, I don't know, language. You know, if people don't like certain words in movies, then they could maybe sort of not bleep them out, but mute them really quickly. So it's a really great player, lots of control, both the way that you control the movie, but also the way that you view the movie or the file. So it's probably one of the best players, really. I mean, it really is. It's just, especially if you want to launch something from a terminal, you might as well launch InPlayer. I mean, it's a great little player. Can't say enough positive things about InPlayer. I love it. Weirdly, I don't use it that much. I tend to just default to whatever Plasma Desktop does now, and I haven't bothered changing anything. But I used to use InPlayer all the time, specifically for sort of the EDL. I mean, I did have to do it backwards, so it was kind of annoying. And eventually, I did actually just switch over to FFmpeg because it was, the workflow was no more complex with FFmpeg. But InPlayer is really nice. It's a really flexible player. Can't say enough about it. So I've said enough about it now, except I said I couldn't do that. Well, I did. So unfortunately, the other component in this package, Mencoder, is not as great. I mean, right now it's unusable. Like it's, well, I shouldn't say it's unusable. Technically it's usable. Like it does, it will do a thing. It just doesn't do it well, and it doesn't do it as completely as it ought to. So Mencoder is the encoder component of the InPlayer package, InPlayer being the decoder. It plays an encoded file, a file that has been encoded into video, into some video format. It decodes that and plays it back for you. But Mincoder or MNcoder or whatever is designed to take a video and then to encode it into some other format of video. That's the idea, at least. I can't stress this enough. Mincoder is currently, as of Slackware 15, or currently, you know, in Slackware 15, it's broken. It does not work. Now, weirdly, it does work. It warns you a lot, and it warns you that it is broken. So it feels like it's going to work. And even worse, even when it fails, it often completes the job. And then even worse, MPlayer plays the thing that MNcoder has produced. The problem is that if you take it to some other player, that other player may not play that file. So you've accidentally made a very, very specific, a player-specific movie file, and that's probably not what you intended. So I would avoid Mincoder wholesale. It just, honestly, I don't 100% understand the value add to Mincoder anyway. It is basically a front end to FFmpeg, or I guess said another way, it's a front end to libav codec. And in fact, I mean, the command, a sample command, is something like mincoder example.mp4, let's say. Or actually, that's probably a bad example because, well, let's do it anyway. MP4, and then dash OVC LAVC. So dash OVC is the out video codec, I guess. Although you're not actually defining the codec. Well, I guess you are because it's libav codec. So that's LAVC in the MPlayer shorthand. And then you need an output audio codec as well, so that's dash OAC, and you define that as LAVC. And then you have to define the options for the codec. So this is a pass-through option, it's dash LAVC opts, and you have to sort of do this weird hybrid of like looking up the options that Mincoder understands, but that FFmpeg provides. So you have to go out to FFmpeg anyway and see what's enabled. You just type FFmpeg into a terminal and it dumps out sort of the configuration. And you can see, like on Slackware, AAC, for instance, is disabled. It says so, dash dash disable dash AAC. Okay, you cannot encode AAC, it is disabled. Whereas something like libvorbis is enabled. So you can go out to libvorbis. So dash LAVC opts would have values like, vcodec equals, let's say, libvpx, and then colon maybe vbitrate. Now these are vbitrate, vcodec, these are valid options because that's what libav codec allows. So vbitrate equals 2100, let's say. And that would change depending on what, you know, what your source is and what you're going out as and so on. Like your source frame size and stuff. Colon a codec equals libvorbis, and then you need an output file. This is a standard Mincoder option, which is just dash o for output. Let's say test.webm, right? That would be what you would expect for libvpx and libvorbis. Actually, you'd probably use libopus, but whatever. That's kind of the direction I'm heading. Or maybe you do .mkv. Maybe you're an MKV fan. I am too. Either way, it's not going to work. Because it turns out that for any container other than AVI or MPEG, MPG, you have to use, libav codec muxers to create those file types, and that is simply broken in Mincoder. It just doesn't work. And even frankly, libopus, and I think, what is it, vorbis or something? They're like experimental, and it complains if you try to use them. So I would not use Mincoder. I would just use FFmpeg. It's more direct, and it's not broken. But MPlayer, don't let my disappointment or my caution about Mincoder, don't let that influence your opinion of MPlayer. MPlayer itself, the decoder, works like a champ, and it really is. Honestly, I think in my dream world we would have FFmpeg, and instead of sort of FFplay, we would just have MPlayer. Like they would just merge. I mean, they don't have to merge, but like that's how you may as well see this. Like MPlayer is the player that FFmpeg doesn't have. Like, you can do ffplay and get playback, but you don't really want to. You want to do mplayer instead. In fact, just alias ffplay equals mplayer. It's fine. I mean, you don't really do that. It's pointless. But I mean, in my mind, that's where mplayer sits. Next package is a network manager dash openvpn. Boy, it's been a while since we've seen a network manager package. But yeah, this is it. This is a network manager dash openvpn. This is the little plugin. I mean, you won't ever realize it's a plugin, because it just appears in your network manager and it's just kind of integrated. But it is the plugin to OpenVPN, I mean to network manager, that enables you to have OpenVPN connections. And this is accessible through either system settings, or you can click on network manager and click the little settings button up in the right corner. It takes you to the connections section of the system settings, and in the left column of the connections panel, you can add an OpenVPN connection. You click the little plus icon down at the bottom of that column. You choose a connection to create, or sorry, it says choose a connection type. That's the literal title of the little sub window. And because you've got network manager dash OpenVPN installed, You have VPN connections options, which include OpenVPN right there on my screen. So, and you can even import a VPN connection. And if it is an OpenVPN configuration file, .ovpn file, then it imports the connection quite well. This I use literally every day, or at least Tuesday through Saturday, Monday through Friday, whatever time zone you're in. And it's just a straight sort of pass through for an OpenVPN connection. You put in all the kind of details that you would for an OpenVPN command, like your gateway server, the connection type, whether you're using a certificate or a password or some kind of key. You insert your CA certificate, your username, assuming your VPN requires one. They usually do, but I guess maybe if you're using like a key or something, maybe not, I don't know. And then a password for that. If you have a password for it, your OpenVPN connection might do something sensible, like using a two-factor authentication, like a sort of a token. So maybe your password isn't static and you actually have to type that in, you know, randomly each time. Doesn't matter. OpenVPN, network manager OpenVPN doesn't care. It's happy to allow you to do that. It'll just prompt you for the password if you don't enter it there. And assuming you've gotten all that information correct and you've got permission to be there, you're suddenly on a VPN. So you've got internet access through your... Oh, and actually that reminds me. So the VPN during the configuration step, this might be if you're importing something, it might already be set. But if you're doing it manually, there is a button in the lower right corner called... is it advanced or is it routes? It is routes. Routes? Routes. R-O-U-T-E-S. Click on that and there's a selection. Use only for resources on this connection, meaning that traffic that doesn't require the address pool provided by the OpenVPN connection don't go through the OpenVPN connection. So you're not like tunneling your traffic through the VPN just to get to a building literally next door to you. That's kind of, I mean, maybe you do want to go through a VPN for the added encryption for everything. But if you don't, then put that, click that checkbox so that you're not sending all of your traffic through the VPN. You're only sending the traffic that you need for work or whatever you're using the VPN for. Okay, that's only two packages. I feel like I'm talking a lot more about these applications that I use either every day or frequently or have used in the past for a long time. A lot more than random libraries meant for like one small task. Either way, it's time for coffee. Let's go get a cup of coffee. We'll come back and do some number of more packages. Be B2 or not B2? You might think I said that backwards, but I didn't. I'm having B2 coffee. Not Bomber, just the B2. It's such a good coffee. My goodness, I'd forgotten how good it was. These flight coffees, I think more than any other coffee, their descriptions of their flavor profile actually like sort of more often than other coffees, it actually rings true. Like, you know, I mean, I hate the descriptions of flavor profiles on coffee anyway, because it always sounds, they always try to make it sound like something other than coffee, you know, which is weird. It's like, but I don't want a caramel parfait, if that's a thing. I don't know if that is, but I want coffee. So it feels weird to describe a coffee as, you know, like notes of chocolate and almond and things like that, because you know that's not what it's going to taste like, and also that's not how you want it to taste. And yet, like, after you taste a flight coffee and then you look at the flavor profile, you kind of get where they're coming from. You know, it's like, oh yeah, okay, I get that sort of rich flavor, that rich aftertaste that might be similar to like a roasted almond. Yeah, I get that. So this one, I don't know what their profile is described as, but it does feel very very rich. But then it's got a little hint, just a little hint. Like sometimes you'll pick up a hint of kind of something like, maybe, I don't know, strawberry-ish. And I hate that because it's not like a strawberry at all. We must never talk about flavors again on this podcast. If I do, just please stop me. Okay, next package is, I think we might be able to get through two more packages this episode. Maybe three if I'm lucky, if I talk fast and focus. So, Audacious. A-U-D-A-C-I-O-U-S. Audacious. It's a media player. Audacious was, for a while, my music player, because it's everything that you need in a music player. I was on Audacious for a while, and then I switched over to Amarok, and then Amarok kind of faltered, and then I kind of switched over to Elisa, just because the display of Elisa is so pretty, and I do like, I sincerely ascribe meaning to album covers, which is silly, because more often than not, the album cover was not something that the artist decided on, and is done completely, you know, just by a marketing department or something. But I don't know. I just, when I started listening to music albums, I didn't know that, and I thought that the album cover was like part of the thing. And so from now on, you know, from here forever, I just think album covers are important. So I really do like them, even if they don't mean anything. I like looking at them, and Elisa does have a beautiful view of those. Audacious, as far as I know, does not, but it's still a really good player. I would say Audacious can be kind of summed up by its interface. I mean, it's a music player for, you know, it's a graphical interface for playing music. And at its really, really, just the most basic is it's a playlist, which, I mean, really is all you need for a music player. You sit down and you think, I want to listen to that one album. And so you put the album into your music player and you press play. That's it. That's what you want. And that's basically what Audacious is. If you go to File, Settings, you can determine, you can decide what interface you want it to use. It's not quite as themable as, say, XMMS, but you do have some pretty significant options. You can do a legacy GTK mode. You can do a Winamp classic interface, which doesn't mean anything to me because I never used Winamp. I never used Windows, so I don't know anything about Winamp, but maybe for some people that's nostalgic. And then there's the Qt interface, which is, of course, what I would use on Plasma Desktop especially, but I mean, I do like Qt anyway, so would use it no matter what, probably. So that's the interface. And the interface, as I say, kind of boils down to the playlist. Like, it's a playlist, and you can put songs into a list and then play the songs. Now, that having been said, there's a lot more going on with Audacious if you want there to be. You can, again, in Settings, you can go to the Plugins menu or panel, I guess, and enable all manner of plugins that give you, I mean, a lot of them are already enabled. It's like for compatibility with various codecs and stuff, but you can do like the audio CD menu items. You can do a playlist manager so that you can create standardized playlists for yourself and then, you know, select from pre-populated playlists. There are various effects. There's spectrum analyzers. There are visual effects. There's channel mixers. There's supposedly a voice removal plugin. I don't think I've ever tried that. Speed and pitch, you can adjust those. Crossfade between songs. Like, there's just all kinds of little touches that may or may not suit what you're looking for. Me personally, I use the playlist manager, although I don't actually make as many playlists, I think, as I sort of intend to. But I do like a good playlist manager. I like being able to get a good combination of albums or usually I go by album. So yeah, it would be a good combination of albums. Sometimes, you know, mix a couple of EPs together and call it an album, that sort of thing. And then stick it into a playlist, a saved file playlist, and then just go back to that when you feel like it. I also have the OpenGL Spectrum Analyzer on, just because that's kind of fun. I mean, I don't know how accurate it is. I don't really care, but it is fun to look at sometimes. There's also the option to display the album artwork, which is in the View menu, Show Info Bar Album Art. So you do get a little bit of a glimpse at the album art if you have the album art either embedded into the song file. I think that's the only way it shows that. I don't think it does the thing of, like, Elisa, where if you've got a file named cover.jpg in the directory of the album, it uses that as the cover. I don't think it does that. Not that I can recall. But yeah, it's a very functional, like, really nice little audio player. It does tie into the media player plugin in the Plasma desktop. So, you know, you get, like, the additional controls, like the controls at a glance, so that if your Audacious window isn't, like, in focus, you can still control your audio playback. So that's quite nice. It's a solid player. It does what it's supposed to do. It is really nice. It is not quite what Amarok used to be. I mean, neither is Elisa, but it's actually pretty darn close to what Amarok was after. Yeah, I think functionally Amarok was what Audacious is now, you know, like, because Amarok could do so much, but at the end of the day, at least for me, I usually, like, ignored 90% of the features and just had the playlist or the you know, the menu of all my musics, and then a playlist, and maybe, yeah, again, the album art, and that was my configuration. Next package is Black Box. Okay, so Black Box, I've never really been a Black Box user, which is kind of interesting because I'm a Fluxbox user. So it's, I don't know why I sort of got onto Fluxbox rather than Blackbox. I don't remember what the decision process was there, but Blackbox is a lot like Fluxbox. But interestingly, Blackbox says that it's a lot like WindowMaker, or wait, what is it called? Yeah, WindowMaker. Except I don't think they call it WindowMaker. GNU WindowMaker is a lot like the Next interface, whatever, Next Step, that's what it was called. So Blackbox claims to be like Next Step, which is kind of interesting because I don't really associate it with that. Like, I see what they're saying. In principle, yes, it is like that. But if you were to ask me to make you a computer that looked and felt like a Nextbox, first of all, I wouldn't know what to do because I've never used one. But second of all, I would not go to Blackbox for it. I would go to WindowMaker. So I don't know. Anyway, design principles are, I mean, it's fair to say that it's like Next Step in the sense that the design principles are similar. So the first thing, if you want to try Blackbox for yourself, first of all, it's a window manager. It's not a desktop. That just means that it's going to manage windows that you make appear on your screen. But how you make those windows appear is kind of up to you. There's no sense of sort of a workflow here. You're not launching a desktop and finding a start menu where all your applications are kept, although there is an application menu, which I'll talk about in a moment. But you're not going to launch the Blackbox interface and find a button for Network Manager, for instance. How do you get online from Blackbox? Well, that's, up again, kind of up to you. You could launch an instance of Network Manager, of the applet, in some kind of panel, but which panel are you going to use? There is a quote-unquote slit S-L-I-T, in the in Blackbox that you can kind of configure and add stuff to, but it kind of depends on the nature of the applet that you want to add. So there is no system tray, really. There's a clock, and that's about it. So it is, you know, like if you're looking for a desktop, then Blackbox is not one. If you are looking for a foundation upon which to build something that does act like a desktop, then Blackbox is perfect for that. Or if you're just looking for a window manager because you don't need all that silly stuff that comes with a desktop, then Blackbox could be for you. So to try Blackbox, the easy way is to launch XWM config. Talked about this in previous episodes in the X directory. XWM config is a really simple, that's XWM as in window manager, config. It's a very simple little scripted application. It simply prompts you for which graphical environment you want to use as your default environment. So if you go to rc.blackbox and press return, well, now it's your default environment. So you can reboot. If you're booting in to run level 3, then you can just type in start X and now you're in Blackbox. If you're going to run level 4, select Blackbox from your SDDM window and you'll be in Blackbox after you sign in. Blackbox, when it first appears, is pretty much a gray screen with a little tiny, technically it's a slit at the bottom of the screen that'll look and not really act. It'll look like a panel to you, but it isn't. It does have a pager function on the far left where you can kind of switch through your virtual workspaces. I think 4 by default. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, it looks like there's 4 by default. And then there is a clock on the right of this panel. And that's kind of it. That's what you get for your interface. So how do you do anything in this environment? Well, it's a bit like TWM, to be honest. So you can right click in the empty gray area of your desktop and you'll see an application menu. This application menu comes from one of two places. By default, it looks in your home directory for a file called, I think it's called like Blackbox, like .blackboxrc. That's what it is, actually. Now, if it doesn't find that file in your home directory, then it goes to /usr/share/blackbox/menu and uses the menu file there. If that fails, it gives you a menu that at least has xterm. So you'll have something. So you can get a terminal open, and from there, I think the intent is that you'll either launch your applications from a terminal, which is a perfectly acceptable way of doing it, or you'll go and edit your own application menu so that the things that you actually use are close at hand. That's at least what I did on Fluxbox, because I mean it is nice, I guess, to have like literally every application on your computer listed in the menu. It does admittedly make sense to have that. I mean, if it's not in your menu, why do you have it on your computer? But then again, like in practice, like on a day-to-day basis, do you use xterm? I don't. I use urxvt or console. I don't need any other option, really. It's nice to know that there is an xterm, I guess, for some reason. Actually, I should probably just uninstall that. But yeah, you might not actually need it in your menu. XPaint. Do I really need XPaint in a menu? Am I ever going to select it? Probably not. And again, I should actually probably just uninstall that. So there are menu entries that are there that maybe, I don't know, maybe at best case scenario, I guess maybe they'll make you question what you have on your computer and inspire you to do a little bit of housekeeping. I don't know. So that's the menu. That's the right click menu. That's the kind of the standard interface to accessing both your applications and kind of your system itself. Like here you could restart Blackbox, you can exit Blackbox, you can reload your Blackbox configuration, you can lock your screen, you can change what style you're using, like what your desktop looks like or what your Blackbox looks like. I don't know what the default is. I'll select green. Oh, that just changes the desktop, the background, interestingly. This is far less, no, here we go. Okay, so there is one that changes really the look and feel of it. I have so many themes for Fluxbox, and by comparison, this just is nowhere anywhere near that. I mean, I'm not saying that Blackbox doesn't have more available. I'm just saying what I'm kind of used to is not here. But these are nice. Yeah, these are cool. This is really nice. I mean, some of them are just wallpaper changes with basically the same window decoration. So I'm not too sure about sort of what's up with that. I mean, some are really quite different. Oh, Rancor is cool. It's like red, deep reds and blacks and stuff. That's cool. So anyway, the windows in Blackbox, a window has on the left upper corner a little icon that looks like maybe a minimize button. Looks like it's going to send it down to your panel, maybe. It has on the right, it's got the telltale box logo that surely means expand to fit your entire screen. Yep, that's what that means. And then it's got an X, which obviously exits out of that window. So the interesting one here, I mean, the two on the right work exactly as you'd expect. But the one on the left, the little minimize button, I mean, it does minimize it, but maybe not in the way that you think. So I've just minimized it, and apparently it's just gone. Like it's nowhere to be seen. If you left click on the desktop area, the empty desktop, it comes up with a menu called Iconified Windows. And sure enough, URXVT is listed there. I click on that and the window reappears. I don't remember that being a feature of Fluxbox. And if it is, I didn't use it ever. Like ever. So I don't feel like it is, but that's kind of cool. I like that. That's fun. But I mean, that is noticeably different than Next, or well, I shouldn't say Next Up, because I don't know, but that's noticeably different than Window Maker either way. Minimize on Window Maker and TWM for that matter, they go to a visible icon, like a little docklet. Well, on Window Maker, it's a docklet, and on TWM, it's just an icon, you know, that you can move around. So it's kind of interesting that's the way Blackbox chooses to implement that feature. Kind of interesting, kind of cool. And there's a lot of configuration that you can do. The slit is highly, highly customizable because it does accept dock apps, is what they're called. They're little applets that run in the slit or a dock of like Window Maker. I don't think Window Maker calls the slit a slit. They just call it like a dock, I think. I don't know why Fluxbox and Blackbox calls it a slit, but that's what they call it. And you can put all kinds of things into the slit, and it's great. It's really neat. It's you can have all kinds of cool little functions, you know, as part of your sort of desktop, at least in theory. In practice, I'm going to admit, a lot of the dock apps at this point are not really well maintained, and they might be very literally designed for, you know, like maybe not literally for the 90s, but definitely for an earlier time, like early 2000s. And they definitely start to show their age. They're showing their age. And I mean, I'm as nostalgic as the next guy. But there is a breaking point. There's a point where it's just like, okay, that's pretty bad. It just not through no fault of its own. It's just the resolutions of modern displays, and it just doesn't work like it used to work. It just doesn't look the same. So I'm not, you know, the dock apps, they have served me well, but I don't know that they are. I feel like their usefulness has started to diminish. I've got a bunch saved that I actually do still use, but again, like they can be hard to find, and some of them just aren't all that functional. The resource file, BlackboxRC, is very well documented. It's in the man page in a section called resource file. It lists all the different properties that are available. The properties are generally a list, kind of a dot delimited list. So you might have something like session.imageDither and then an option, true or false. I don't know what that does, but I could read the description to find out. Session.screen some number dot workspaces and then an integer. This creates workspaces by middle clicking on the desktop and choosing new workspace or remove last. After creating workspace, right click on the toolbar to name it. Default is one. I actually didn't know that about Blackbox. I wonder if that, does Fluxbox, can I do that on Fluxbox? Well, I don't know. I'll have to try that sometime. Anyway, Blackbox, lots of configuration options. Really nice little platform to play around on. Don't know why I've never used it. I think it might literally only be because of how it handles the keyboard shortcuts. Blackbox rather uses something called BB keys, and that's a separate command. And I keep forgetting for whatever reason on my virtual machine, my keyboard is different. Like, it's not, it doesn't, it's not, I guess I must have that set somewhere else. I don't know. It's weird. So BB keys is the key grabber for Blackbox, whereas Fluxbox just uses, like, Fluxbox just handles that itself. So all of your keyboard shortcuts are in the same place as everything else. I think they are in a different file, but I mean, they go in the same folder. So it just, I don't know. It seems easy. I mean, it could have just been a flip of a coin. Fluxbox, Blackbox. I might have heard of Fluxbox on Chess Griffin's podcast, Linux Reality, and just went with that because he mentioned it. I think that might be it, actually. So nothing against Blackbox, I guess, but I just don't have the experience with Blackbox that I have with Fluxbox. But it's cool. It's fine. It's a good one. You can use it. Okay, and the next one is Blue Man, BLUE. Actually, you know what? Before I go on to Blue Man, let's talk really quick about Blackbox Window Manager. Let's find out what its status of development actually is. It looks like there is a repository that has had a merged pull request 7 months ago. This is the Blackbox, a fork of the original Blackbox CVS that is on SourceForge. This fork is on GitHub. It includes all changes made on the official Blackbox CVS repo, as well as patches collected from PDL, Linux, Debian, and the Blackbox bug list, and other GitHub forks. Yeah, okay, so that's not bad. I mean, that feels like it's being maintained. And if you're looking for a GUI for configuration, apparently there's bbconf, which is a Qt program that helps you configure Blackbox. So actually lots of good reasons to use Blackbox. I'm glad I did that. I will include that link in the show notes, because those are compelling progress or development. I'm not going to use it. I mean, nothing against it. I'm well invested into Fluxbox. I'm not going to switch to Blackbox until I have a good reason to. But I don't know, if I were looking at window managers today, I think I'd be looking, Blackbox would definitely be one that I looked at. Okay, now let's talk about Blue Man. Blue Man is a Bluetooth configuration menu that appears probably in your system tray. I'm trying to find, here it is, Bluetooth. It's just called Bluetooth. You click on it, and if Bluetooth isn't enabled, then it prompts you to enable Bluetooth. And then once Bluetooth is enabled, it does the typical Bluetooth thing where it scans for a device, and then it lets you connect to the device. I hate Bluetooth. I think it's just a horrible protocol. I really do. I do not like it. It does not work well. It is not well enough standardized that you can just get a Bluetooth device and just count on it working with Bluetooth. So I don't understand the appeal. I understand the appeal, the theoretical appeal of very close range or near range, close range, whatever, close range wireless connection. I get the appeal there. I don't think Bluetooth is fit for purpose. I think it's probably very close to being fit for purpose, but whatever it is, and I don't know if it's just not enforcing standards enough or whether, I don't know. But Bluetooth is not, for me, it's not the answer. I do not like it. I use Bluetooth for headphones, like earphones for my mobile device, and that's about it. And even that's just to listen to podcasts while I'm doing chores around the house or out in the lawn. So I don't like Bluetooth. I don't think it works well. That's all I have to say about Blue Man. Honestly, I mean, I'm sure Blue Man is very good, and I don't mean to blame anything on Blue Man. I'm just saying I don't like Bluetooth, and Blue Man has everything to do with Bluetooth, so I don't want to talk a whole lot about it. All right, next up is DDD. Launch that, and you get just a gorgeous interface that is a front end to GDB, which is the GNU debugger program. I think there's a lot of value to this one. You know, I mean, there are some of these applications that we were looking at in X, I mean, the X directory, I just couldn't understand why they existed, like that mail program or even X edit. I just didn't understand why they were there because it just didn't seem to add anything. But GDB is not a simple application. Like, there's a lot of keyboard shortcuts to remember. There's a lot of functionality that you might not even realize you want until you need it. And then how do you discover functions in a terminal, you know, in a command, in something that you have to know to look for the thing that you want to do. It can get a little bit weirdly complex. Whereas if it's in a GUI, click on a menu and just kind of like look around for a while, you might stumble onto something cool. And I think that's really the value to DDD. I don't know that DDD probably, I mean, I've never used DDD and I've barely used GDB, but I don't know if there's anything in DDD that would just be super hard to re-implement in GDB. I kind of doubt it. I'm not seeing, you know, certainly if I'm clicking around, I don't really see any kind of function that I'm just like, oh, that would be so much easier in a GUI than in a terminal UI. But I do think that just the discoverability could be, I think that's probably the added value. There is also the additional bonus, I think, of like whatever this was written in, and I don't actually, is this TK or something? I don't know what this horrible widget set is. Is this Motif? No, maybe. I don't know. I don't know what it is. Athena, Motif, TC, TK, TCL, ITK, whatever. I don't know. But whatever it is, there's this convention, and I've seen this in a couple of different applications, where you can click on a menu, and then there's this dotted line under it. And if you click on the dotted line, it breaks out into its own window. Maybe it's just like GTK1 or something. Could that be what it is? It says it is compiled with GCC Motif. It is Motif. Interesting. Oh, and it includes XPM and Athena Panner. So it's all of the things I mentioned somehow. Weird. Okay, so anyway, I do like that feature. So the menu becomes its own window. And so you could kind of like, you can kind of dock menus. And that just seems like a really, really clever idea. Like that's a design feature we ought to bring back. So like I say, I've never used DDD. I barely use GDB, so I don't want to comment uselessly about it. But let's just say that this is a front end for debuggers, including GDB, DBX, don't even know what that is, WDB, don't know what that is, Ladybug, JDB, XDB, and the Perl debugger, and the Bash debugger, and the Python debugger. It's amazing. Like, it's so many things. That's very cool, but not something that I have ever used myself. What I have used is EasyTag. That's up next. EasyTag is a GTK application for doing ID3 tags on music files, and I've done this a lot because modern music players, they just don't like things that aren't tagged. You know, they just don't know how to just read a file name and show you the file name. They just, or even to sort of divine how to present something from a file name. You know, artist_album_song title just somehow isn't a recognized standard in music players, in modern media players. It has to be an ID3 tag. So I'm always tagging media that I've either realized I've never tagged, or something that I've just ripped from a CD, because I still buy CDs because I like to have them as backups. Whatever the case, EasyTag is one of the great applications for that purpose. And I say one of, because the other one is KID, KID3, I guess is probably what it's called. I don't know, KID V3 maybe? I don't know. It's the cute one. It's the KDE one. But the EasyTag is the GTK one, and it's fine. On the left, it shows you a bunch of directories, and it searches through those directories for songs by default. I think you can limit the scope of it or tell it to stop searching. I go to just my music folder and to the specific album that I'm tagging. And then those songs in that album appear in the sort of the middle panel. And then in the right panel, or in the right column, are all of the tags. you can type in a tag, click, you can select one song and type in a tag. Now, if that tag spans all songs, if that's true for all songs, you can then select all of the songs and click this little double T button. I'm not really sure why it's a double T, track to track. I don't know. And that applies that tag to all of the songs. So you can just tag basically one song with like artist, album name, comment, producer, you know, whatever you record in your tags, and then select all of them, click the copy to all track button essentially, and it copies it all. You still would have to go through each one and put in the title, but at least you get like, you know, 9/10 of the job done all in one click. Assuming it's an album with a consistent single artist. I mean, if it's like a mix album where you have to do all of the artists separately, well, you're not going to do that then. But I mean, still the album name might be the same. There's also this is a tabbed interface on the right. So you can click over to the image section and attach like an image file to the song, like embed your cover art there. The media players I've used recently respect a cover.jpg in the same folder as the songs and assigns that as the cover image. Not all do, so I'm probably going to regret doing it that way the next time I change media players, but that's what I'm doing for now. And when I need to add a cover art to each track so that my new media player shows me the art, I guess I'll just go back to Easy Tag and do it all over again. Once you've tagged all the songs that you want to tag within an album, you can click the save button and it'll save all of the modified tracks. It's a really basic interface and it's really pretty straightforward. I'd never used it. I don't even think I meant to use it. It was just one of those things where I was right clicking on a file and I saw Easy Tag and thought, that sounds good, I'll try that. Tried it and loved it. It's kind of a go-to tagger for me because the KID, as great as it is, KID does so many ID versions, like ID V3, ID V2, and sometimes I think Easy Tag must just do the latest and greatest. It's just kind of a no-brainer. You just put in your tag, save it, and you're done. And I think that's it for this episode. Why? Because I'm done my coffee. So let's end it right now, but I'll talk to you next week. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep the source open.
soldiers uses mountain grown coffee.
Yeah, that's richest kind. No trick to making coffee. All you need is a better coffee.